Hello and welcome to episode 168 of WB40, the weekly podcast with me, Matt Ballantyne, Chris Weston and Amy Keane. Well, here we are again, slightly later than usual because of a complex series of events, mostly involving North Yorkshire and a caravan. What have you been up to, Mr. Weston?
Well, I was away. I went away for the weekend and I was away for the first 2 days of this week. So today is my first day back at work. And yes, I was in a caravan as a the start of a long-term experiment into holidaying in the UK and clearly not going anywhere. And having been to a couple of places, hotels in the early stages of this whole folder roll, it's just painful, right? Everything's painful. You have to turn up everywhere later than you used to. You have to get out later, get out earlier than you used to because they've got to do all of their pretending to clean everything more effectively. And it's just rubbish. So I thought, well, what if I find a way of taking my own places? And one of those ways has been invented already. So we thought we'd give it a try, and that was it. I mean, okay, October in North Yorkshire, it's not always going to be sunshine and all that, but there was quite a lot of rain. But other than that, I mean, frankly, it was good fun, and I enjoyed myself. So we'll do a bit more of that, and all was well in terms of the logistics and mechanics. So I'm you know, safe and sound and back. And it's quite a good week in that sense. And also last week was also good fun because, I mean, I think I said on the podcast last week I'd been out and actually seen somebody and had a coffee with Gordon McMullen, an old contact of mine who I've known for quite some time. And then on Thursday I did a panel thing. It wasn't a manel, Matt. It was a panel for Investigo people. And that was good fun, and we did some roundtable stuff with our CIO network, which was great, and yeah, it was last week was quite good fun, and what's remaining of it this week should be good as well. What about you?
There's four letters that have sort of summed up my last couple of weeks. The letters G, D, P, and R.
G, D, P, R.
Armageddon. That's been fun. Apart from that, I kind of had this sudden moment of realization in about 48 hours ago that I've spent most of the last 3 months writing business cases, and I've completely lost sight of actually doing anything that is about why. It's just the kind of, you know, it's the nature of being in a bureaucratic organization is where these things happen. I don't use bureaucracy in a pejorative sense. It's just, you know, things need to happen in certain ways. But anyway, so I got talking to somebody else and chatting with Dave Floyd, one of our esteemed audience and active contributor to the WB40 WhatsApp channel. If you want to join, just drop us a tweet. Realized that I think is now the time to unleash the concept of the digital twin into the world of social housing, which is
careful, on the one hand,
I know. I mean, the thing is, I don't think we'll be delivering digital twins anytime soon, but the idea of actually what it would be if we knew where every component in somebody's home was and what it was, so that we could know things, as opposed to at the moment, where particularly with the old stock, we don't really know that much because it's quite complicated to be able to build up digital twins of stuff that was built in the 1890s. So anyway, I've been thinking about digital twins a bit and what we might be able to do in the future if we start thinking of data as a valuable resource to be leveraged rather than just stuff.
The future.
Sits in systems. Yes, the future.
Well, so funnily enough, another thing that I was doing last week, which I was talking to you and the WhatsApp folk about, was I've been doing quite a lot of reading around strategy, not about strategy as an abstract concept, because, good Lord, there's enough of that, but actually reading IT strategies from different organizations and just to see what they put in them, because I know what I tend to put in them. But I was interested to see what other people put in them. And let me tell you, I read some corkers. I don't recommend it as a way to inject life and light into your week. But my word, there's some interesting documents in terms of why people decide that they want to put certain things in a document, which led me around the kind of a whole kind of circle all the way back to why are these things important, and who's going to read them, and do people really consider their readership before they create some of these things? And the idea that it essentially a strategy is a bit of a business case anyway, a business case to exist really, and to justify your enormous salary as an IT leader. There's a lot of psychology and performance in it, and that just as there is around business cases. And we've got another one of our roundtables tomorrow, and Ian Golding, another one of our crew, who isn't going to join us tomorrow because he's doing something else. But he sent me an email, and he said basically, I can't remember what he's on about, but I think it's something we touched on last week or maybe the week before. And he says, oh, you know, budget isn't such a problem as long as you're doing good stuff, because actually you've got endless budget, which plays into a little bit of something that you've been saying this week about, you know, why do IT budgets look like IT budgets? And Ian's point was, and it's one I've always taken the view of, that if you're doing good enough stuff, you'll get money anyway. You know, you shouldn't worry too much about budget, because you'll be delivering value, and therefore there's always money for stuff that delivers value. So yeah, anyway, that's a long and rambling way of saying, yeah, Matt, yeah, that's right.
Thank you. And anyway, joining us, you'll be pleased to hear, dear listener, on the show this week, we also have somebody who isn't me or Chris, Amy Keane. How the devil are you?
Woo!
Hello, Amy.
Hello. I'm actually pretty good, thank you.
Good to hear.
9 out of 10, I'd say.
Wow. Maybe we should start introducing scoring for how we are at the beginning of the week.
Yeah, that would be good.
Well, what's your score? What are you both packing?
I'll be doing out of 5, because I have the thing called the chuff factor, which every morning at the stand up for the team, we go around and we tell each other what we're doing for the day ahead, and then we give ourselves a score of 1 to 5, where 1 is not in any way chuffed and 5 is extremely as chuffed as you can be. And I've been tracking about 3.5 to 4 for the last few weeks. Because you can never give a 5, because I come from Presbyterian Northern Irish stock and we're never that positive about bloody anything.
See, that's interesting. I mean, I'm probably about an 8 at the moment, which is, yeah, pretty good. I mean, I always leave myself a little bit of room for improvement. But I your chuff factor, Matt, it doesn't sit very well with me, that, because, you know, where I come from, chuff is a kind of expression of displeasure, and the description of a particular part of anatomy, and it's not really something to be asked about in the morning.
Well, I think that's the north south divide in microcosm there, basically. How's your week been, Amy?
I'm so sorry. I was quickly just trying to Google what part of the anatomy. I feel like I need to know.
Have you found it?
No. There's a bird. There's also a bird called a chuff, which dominates the Google results, and I panicked.
Well, if you haven't found out by the end of recording, I'll let you know. I'll let you know then.
We do a big reveal at the end of the word. How's my week been was the question. You know what, I've had the most incredible epiphany this week, genuinely, because I'm doing many things at the moment. I started working for myself about 2 months ago, but one of the things that I most enjoy is lecturing at Kingston University. So I'm a lecturer, I'm teaching first year students about the history of art and culture, and this week is reading week. So I've got this week off, and I had a weird epiphany. I went for brunch with my friend who works at Pinterest yesterday, a lady called Carly Gooch. And after brunch, I was like, shit, I work for myself. I can do what I want. And I've been, for the last 2 months, I've been working like a mad woman, all hours of the day, stressing myself out. And I thought, actually, I don't know. I absolutely don't need to do that. So I went to Foyles and I bought 4 books and I just read all day yesterday. And I don't know that I've ever done that on a weekday before. And it was remarkable.
That's quite. Have you worked for yourself before?
Nope. No, this is the first one.
Yeah, this is the bit I miss, being able to have that fluidity and flexibility. Yeah. And just be able to, oh, yeah, I'm going to spend the day reading. On the other hand, the fact I can take Friday off and also get paid is still like a massive novelty after having been working for myself for 6 years.
You are the boss, though, Matt. You know, you're the boss of your little team. This is part of the privilege of being the boss, is you can go out on a Friday afternoon and say, "Oh, I'll be back next week," and nobody asks you where you're going because you're the boss.
Yeah, it doesn't work like that when everybody's working from home and they've got video calls. It's changed the dynamic quite dramatically. I think it's democratizing and it's flattened structures without anybody
being. It's removed the privileges of rank, which I find absolutely much distasteful. I'm not going back into a job where I'm have any responsibility, if that's what's happened.
So, Amy, we're going to talk with you on this week's show about stuff around the world of marketing and advertising and agencies and a whole bunch of things. So I think what we should do is probably get on with it. So I think it's important to note that the professional technologist in the virtual room, Christopher, this week is outnumbered by the sociologists in the house. Because, Amy, you and I, sociology, you know. But you're kind of turning your attention increasingly now to the sociology of advertising and to the culture that exists within the world of advertising. How did you get there?
So the two things weirdly kind of merge, even though one's public facing and one's about how we function and interact with each other from an advertising industry perspective, because it's all about how people think, and it's all about the lack of respect that advertising practitioners generally tend to have for the human race, which I noticed very early on in my career. So I've worked in advertising now, 16 years. And I've worked at media agencies, creative agencies. I did a stint, actually quite a long stint in PR. I've also worked in APAC. So I was head of strategy for an agency across Asia Pacific for a few years. Working for Mindshare, which is why I don't know if you heard about all that Nick Emery stuff.
No.
Oh, I'm digressing slightly, but it's just quite interesting. The global CEO of Mindshare just got fired for flashing his arse on a company Zoom.
Doesn't surprise me.
Didn't surprise me either. But that's an aside. So I worked for various different agencies, and what's interesting is that, as you are, Matt, I'm a sociologist, kind of psychologist, academically, and that makes us a bit more thoughtful than a lot of people who work in media. And so I have always found myself in these kind of peripheral roles, head of innovation, head of futures, head of, you know, like the wanky role that kind of sits in the corner and observes and tries to get the agency to do new stuff and tries to get people thinking differently. And when you work as head of innovation, and I've done that job in a couple of different companies, inevitably you have to try and change the culture. If you need to get an organization to try and do new stuff, embrace new technologies or plan differently or whatever, you need to try and change the way that people behave and the way that people think. And what I realized very quickly is that, particularly within the advertising space, but it's kind of universal in corporate culture, is that the way that people think and the way that people behave isn't very nice. And so over the years, I've noticed, you know, things like microaggressions, the way that we, you know, banter, but the way that we talk to other people, the way that we, the little jokes and the nasty things that we say and to other, but also generally, you know, the long hours that we force people to work, the stress that we force onto people from, you know, the age of 20, as soon as they hit the world of work, all of these things don't need to happen. particularly in advertising, where you're just dealing with making ads. But interestingly, advertising is the most, there's loads of studies that show that advertising and media is the most stressful industry out of them all, more stressful than being a doctor or a nurse, or more stressful than flying a plane.
Let's just, for people who aren't familiar with the world of agency, just unpack a little bit about the different sorts of organisations there are. So you've got creative agencies.
Yes.
Which is, guess, I would have thought would have been what most people would think of when they think of an advertising agency.
Yeah, that's your Mad Men type outfit.
Yeah.
They make the ads. They have these kind of eureka moments about what makes people tick, and then
and then you've got the media agencies.
Yeah, so media agencies buy the space. So normally a media agency in theory would write the strategy, kind of a different kind of strategy to the one that you were talking about earlier, Chris, like a communication strategy that tells the brand where to advertise, when to advertise, and exactly what people to target. So that's what the media agency does. And then they buy the space.
And then you've got PR.
Mm-hmm. Which is obviously the oldest of all the communications techniques.
And we've got, I guess, digital agencies, which is the one that I guess is closest to some of the stuff in the world of technology, which I'm not sure anybody understands really what a digital agency is.
They mostly do SEO.
And we had mobile agencies for a while, but I think that has that fad passed now, or
yes.
Got any of those? And then so there's all these things, and the cultures within them are actually quite in many cases are actually really quite different, aren't they? So the difference between a creative agency and a media agency, they don't like each other, from my experience.
They despise each other, because, well, I'll tell you why. It's because, and I don't know if you've ever had this, but clients can be quite abusive, particularly if they're insecure. And abusive, I know it's quite a strong word, but when you're briefing agencies with only 24 hours notice and you're giving really shit feedback and you don't quite know what you're doing, so you kind of overcompensate and give your agency shit because, you know, you're embarrassed, or you don't, you know, the both media agency and creative agency end up getting treated very badly and trying to blame the other. Creative agencies think that everything advertising is about the craft, and it should be, but media agencies know people inside out. They have loads of data. They have the robustness. They work out whether an ad is effective or not. So they both think they're sets of geniuses, and they clash. But they're very different people. It's kind of art and science. So they lock horns quite a lot.
And then you've got, presumably within that world now as well, also a new realm of data-focused people who are probably in either camp.
Yeah, that just, yeah. I'm bored already. Yeah, they just kind of talk the language. But the thing is, I mean, it's so amazing. Now, I don't work for any, because I've worked for all the massive holding companies like WPP and Publicis. I don't work for any of them now. And so I can be very honest about the fact that most agencies, massive data platforms, are fictional, don't even exist. Smoke and mirrors. Like they're a bunch of mock-ups on PowerPoint slides, with a few very clever data people who are able to reel off an impressive sounding script.
You shock me. I'm shocked to the core, because that hasn't been going on in the tech world for the last 40 years.
Oh no, sounds entirely standard to me. I don't see how that's some kind of revelation. That's exactly how all software works, and all corporate software hangs together. There's just some people at the back with shovels moving stuff around, and it's like the Flintstones. It's always like the Flintstones. You know, like the Flintstones have, ostensibly they have sort of automation going on, but at the end, at the back, there's some animal pretending to be, that's basically how it all works.
And so within these different sorts of bits of that industry, and which increasingly, of course, it's not only the way in which they're shaping what we think about stuff, and what we buy. But the reach of all of this stuff and the impact that it's having around us is incredibly broad, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what kind of stuff do you mean? The reach of what stuff?
Well, just if you think, potted theory for you.
Yeah.
Apple was on its arse, basically, in about 1996.
Yeah.
And the only reason it kept going was because it had embedded itself into the creative industries, agency world, and the world of publishing as well.
Yeah.
And from that, and from the fact that the arbiters of what is good taste and style sort of congregate around the worlds of advertising, marketing, and so on, and PR, and therefore, why is Apple now the richest company in the world? It's because I'm certain, in large part, because they made the machines that even when Jobs wasn't there and they were crap, were the machines that were used by people in the advertising industry.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the ability to be able to create these massive pots of wealth, or Google is in its position of enormous great power because Google is, above everything else, an advertising sales platform.
Yeah. Although when I've never been to Cannes, I've never been to either the film festival or the advertising festival, but I've been told that whereas maybe 10 years ago, Cannes, the advertising festival, was filled with all of the creative agencies, you know, it was true creativity, very middle class, lots of people getting pissed, doing dubious things. Now it's all the tech players that dominate advertising. I remember when Facebook first entered the market, God, was selling advertising, which must have been about 2010. All of a sudden, the industry felt soulless. All of a sudden, it felt like all creativity had been sucked out of the industry because they didn't allow you to do much. It was filled with regulation in terms of the amount of copy that you could use, the amount of things that you could say. You only had like this tiny space that you had to fill, but everybody knew that Facebook advertising was so damn effective because everybody was on that platform at the time. And I remember when I used to work, so I worked at media agencies for many years. Around that time, like 2010 to 2015, when Facebook was just charged in a tank, everyone was like, they used to get me and my leadership team into a room every quarter and shout at us for not spending enough money with them. And we'd be like, okay, sorry, Facebook, we'll do better. We're sorry. Because also the way that it works with, you know, all of these major tech players is that the more money you give them, the more beaters they throw at you, you know, the more innovation they let you use. So it made advertising, like talking about digital agencies and no one really knows what they do, it just made advertising so digital and kind of overly regulated and so boxed in, but you had no choice.
Well, can I just pick up on that a little bit? Because something that, because I've been thinking about what you're saying about, you know, everybody hating everybody else and not really understanding what they do or valuing it. And I'd say this, you know, most people in business would look at the marketing team and you know, that's where the crowns are kept, right? And that's what marketing do. They colour things in, which is to denigrate a lot of what marketing is, no doubt. And there's a lot of skill in marketing. But then when I was in, so I was working with a guy called Will Wright a few years ago, who Matt, you've met, and Will's a really, really clever guy. And he spent some time in marketing and he would say that marketing essentially has let itself get into that position, partly from what you're saying, because they've given up on the data, they've given up on everything, and they've just sort of, they've confined themselves to the colouring pens. And then I remember, I was trying to think who it was, but I was speaking to a lady a couple of years ago, and she was basically bemoaning the fact that every single marketing executive or person she speaks to now just tends to be a young guy or a young girl, 22, 23 years old, you know, very attractive, no experience, who doesn't do anything other than organize a bit of SEO and as you say, goes to their agencies with a bunch of crap requirements because they have no idea what they're asking for. And this is kind of this has kind of happened because all the marketing has been hollowed out, maybe because people think Facebook can do it all. I don't know.
Yep. That's basically exactly what happened. So if you look at a few years ago, marketing budgets were 50% TV, because you have to advertise on TV because that's where, you know, at least in the UK, that's where everybody is, ITV. But then the rest of the budget was normally Facebook. And that's it. And, you know, where's the imagination? Where's the planning? Where's the understanding of humans? It's such a shame. I like to think. And then obviously when influencer marketing started to become a thing 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I can see your face. Then money starts, you know, money's been ploughed into that space now. At least influencer marketing has a bit more personality. Whether you like those personalities or not, at least there's a bit of unpredictability and a bit of spice.
I'm just a bit upset that I haven't got my influencer money yet. I'm waiting for somebody to come and offer, you know, wanting to be their brand ambassador. Yeah, I can't be their brand ambassador.
I mentioned the caravans enough for you at the beginning, Chris.
Who would you be a brand ambassador for? What's your dream?
Oh no, Ginsters, maybe? I don't know. I'm sure I could, you know, I could wear gym wear if people wanted me to. It's all, you know, I'm multi-talented. I could do anything. For money, I will do anything.
Oh, and that is the essence of influencer marketing, isn't it? Fantastic. So what are some of the elements that you in your journey through this world, this slightly crazy world of agencies, what are some of the things about it that you want to change? Because you do have a drive behind you to just want to make stuff better.
I really do. And it's purely selfish. I want my life to be easy. So I want... So primarily, diversity is a massive issue. It's not just a gender thing. It's a race thing. It's a sexuality thing. It's an age thing as well. You know, in advertising agencies, when you hit 40, you're out. Get out. What do you know? You on TikTok? Get out. So I've had the privilege of working with many sexist, posh men who haven't been very pleasant to me, or lots of other women, and it's made me so cross that I am dedicated to lifting up women in our industry and trying to encourage them not to apologize before they ask a question in a meeting. I've just launched I'm so excited about it. I've just launched a course thing. I don't know what it is, like an immersive training course thing called Practice Makes Unperfect, which is primarily for women in the advertising industry to help them work out what their voice is. And to fucking use it. There's also a lot of classism in our industry, and I'm from Essex, and I remember when I first started working all those years ago, I'm also blondish. I dyed my hair black, I started wearing glasses, and I tried to change my voice because I didn't want to be that blonde girl from Essex, because people, and then for years afterwards, I mean, my accent's kind of there, is it? I don't know.
So there's still an ethics twang there.
There's a twang. Classism in our industry is rife. It's rife. 15%, only 15% of the entire advertising industry workforce didn't go to private school.
Wow. That's amazing.
Mind-blowing. And the reason I know that, so there's an organisation, it's like a trade body called the Institute of Practitioners for Advertising, the IPA. They do a census every year. So that's how we know those stats. Oh, also, fun fact, the gender pay gap is going up, which is good.
Oh, man. That thing about class is really interesting, actually, because I think the DICE thing, we'll talk about DICE in a minute, but the thing about diversity and inclusion in the tech industry and events in the tech industry, something Chris and I have been you know, aware of for some years now, and have been trying to do our own little things to be able to try to be able to address in our sector. And, you know, we still do get all male panels. We still do get massively undiverse audiences where, you know, a grey suit rather than a dark blue suit is somehow seeing as setting yourself apart. But there is, I think, increasingly an awareness of it. Yeah. It's interesting. I think race is an issue. I think gender is definitely an issue in tech. I think issues around age, probably in certain parts of it. I think around sexuality is an issue. Mm. I've never heard anybody talking about issues about class in the tech industry. And I wonder whether that's, it isn't so much of a problem because no bucker wants to work in IT who's been to private school. Whereas if you've got a trust fund and an Alice band, then it's straight into advertising or publishing with you. And I have worked in advertising and publishing, so I have seen the Alice bands.
I guess interestingly, so I went to, I think it was last year. This was one of the reasons why I decided to launch DICE. I went to a conference on robotics, robotics and artificial intelligence, I think like at the University of Cranfield or something. Mm-hmm. And I think there was one woman on a lineup of 20 people. And at the time, how bad is this? I'm not sure I even noticed because I just expected it. But there was one panel, which was about the future of robotics, and a woman in the audience put her hand up and said, are you aware that you're all men? And do you work with any women? And did you not fancy, I don't know, maybe sending a woman in your place? Or do you think, you know, or do you think, you know, what are you going to do? What are you guys going to do to try and encourage more women to work in the robotic space? And they all kind of just sat there like, ugh, I don't want to touch this. And one of the guys said, you know what, all we can do is say for all of you in the audience, if you've got daughters, tell them to do a STEM degree at university. And I was like, oh, for fuck's sake. All right. So we just cancel out all the women until then.
It's good to know that actually it was a technology event that was the inspiration behind this. I kind of find that reassuring in a way. So what is DICE about? What is it? What are your aims behind it?
Yeah, so Chris, I believe you mentioned the M word at the beginning of our sesh, Manal. So the main objective for DICE, which stands for Diversity and Inclusion at Conferences and Events, is to get rid of the Manal, not because we hate men. There's men sitting on the founding team, the board. It's because, and the advertising industry churns out events, so that's why I've seen it more than maybe others. If you look on a stage, you know, events in any industry, tech, travel and tourism, finance, whatever, events in any industry are supposed to represent the industry in its entirety. They're supposed to represent the way that industry thinks. They're supposed to represent the future of that industry. If you don't see someone like you or someone that talks like you or thinks like you on that stage, then why on earth would you believe that you belong in that industry? And that's the thing. So you talk about events and you think, well, it's just events. But actually, it's really, really significant. Because in advertising a lot, and that's the industry that I've grown up in, the views that, and it's nothing against white men. White men are awesome, but only the views of white men are celebrated. And that's incorrect. It's wrong. So we established DICE to try and educate people to curate more diverse, more inclusive conference lineups.
So your aim is to focus at people who are organising events, whatever sector.
Yep.
And what, provide them support to be able to think about how they get more inclusive in how they organise their events?
Well, what we realised is that, and obviously rightly so, the subject of D&I is extremely emotional. There's lots of people who feel very, very passionately about it. Either they've been on the receiving end of prejudice or, you know, it's their lives. So we decided to take all of the emotion out of it. There's lots of people who are far more qualified to talk about diversity than me, but I can get shit done. So what we chose to do was create a charter, which is kind of it's an education tool, but it's also a process of certification that's based on the 2010 Equality Act. So the 2010 Equality Act kind of sets out all the ways in which it is illegal to actively discriminate. So the Equality Act has 9 protected characteristics: gender, race, age, disability, sexuality, religion, so on. Some of them are more relevant than others for events. So DICE is a charter based on equality law that sets out, and it's also based on national statistics as well, because we have to be realistic, sets out how we believe people should be making their events diverse. So, for example, you should only ever have a maximum of 50% men. You should only ever have a maximum of 70% white people. Now, it's based on BAME statistics in the UK. It's based on assumptions that most conferences, when we created it before COVID, would be based in larger cities like London or New York. But also the charter itself is always fluid, and we're kind of updating it all the time. And when we first created it, so it's 10 points, you get a score of 10% for each point, and then you get a total score of 100%. If you get over 40%, you get DICE certified. So that shows that you've tried. Is all of this making sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So it's really actually,
If you get 100%, oh my God. I mean, very few people do. A couple of people have. We've certified so many events companies over the last year since it's been in operation, which I tell you, I'll be totally honest, is a pain in the ass, because it's voluntary and I have to do loads of bloody admin. But this is what happens when you preach and you try to position yourself as a good person. It bites you in the ass.
And with the madness that is the world of events in 2020, do you think this is getting easier if you're not tied to physical location? Is there now less of an excuse?
You'd think, you'd absolutely think, but it's getting worse. And I don't know why. So what we did, obviously, when everyone, you know, when lockdown started, lots of events companies had to pivot, and they had to really quickly work out how to do virtual events. And it was obviously, you know, a very stressful time. So we gave them a bit of breathing space. We gave them a couple of months, and then we launched back with a bang, and said, right, okay, you've had your space, sort your shit out. And for some reason, I don't know whether it's because people are stuck in their offices at home and they're not meeting people, or they're not, you know, they're only relying on their really kind of small contact base, or I don't know whether they're not going to events themselves or getting inspiration. I'm not sure what it is, but I've seen more all-male panels in the last month than I think I've ever seen. In every industry, in government, in tech, in agriculture, and Americans are the worst. And most events are all white men called Ken.
That is worrying, though, isn't it? Because the it's that kind of thing when you maybe Duff analogy, but go with it. Time management. Every so often I get into I will do a to-do list. I've learned recently that's pointless, because it just basically is self-flagellation. You should actually just do a schedule, but that's another story. But I do a to-do list, and then I'll get into it, and I'll be really good, and I'll be, you know, urgent, important, and all that TMI stuff, and then, ooh, and then some sort of crisis will hit, and the first thing that goes is my diligent time management techniques.
Yeah.
So it's not just me that happens for. It's like most people who I've ever taught time management skills to over the years. Yeah. And maybe there's a bit of that going on, that when you get into certain a time of uncertainty, you revert back to old behaviours. You revert back to just doing the easy.
Yep. That's exactly it. Also, there's an assumption that only the big names will sell tickets. Companies are desperate to sell tickets for events at the moment because they're desperate to stay afloat. And so inevitably there's like five names in every industry that people will pay to see, is the assumption. And so a lot of companies are reverting to those names across every single industry. But on the other hand, the organizations who are DICE certified, Advertising Week was, which is a massive week-long festival that went virtual, loads of companies across like finance and government becoming DICE certified. And these events, like a dive, it's a fact that a diverse event with different people from different cultures and people with different perspectives and people with different personalities. I mean, neurodiversity is a massive thing. Disability often gets ignored. It's a better event. It's just more interesting. It's just more entertaining. But it's a risk, I guess. Diversity is still considered a risk in many companies.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. And you know, having just done an event myself, we've set an event up and ran an event a few weeks ago, and getting female speakers was really, really hard. And yeah, we really tried to get a diverse conversation going. We had some HR people. It was a CIO conference, but we tried to get, you know, people from different areas. But still, it's just so tough, because at the end of the day, the people who are sponsoring your conference want certain things, and I don't know whether the women that are normally speaking at events have kind of gone to ground and have got better things to do. I think that's part of it. Yeah. I really do think that's part of it. I think they're just more sensible and have got better things to do with their time than preening in front of a bunch of pasty guys staring at their video screens. And that would make absolute sense to me. Yeah. But it's very, very, it is very hard. I mean, getting a panel with, just in terms of gender diversity, getting a panel with women on it when you're doing tech stuff.
Yeah.
There are women out there, but there aren't, you know, there's a far fewer proportion of women to men who are available and willing to talk and all of that kind of thing. And I hate to see it. I really hate to see it. It winds me up no end when we have non-diverse panels in many, many ways. But gosh, it's hard. And I think it's hard. I think it's even harder right now. I don't know why, but I do think it is.
I totally agree with you. There's a couple of things there. I think right now there's the issue of logistics. Childcare is, you know, God, we could get into the traditional gender roles of families. I don't think we've got time. Childcare has been an issue, just timing generally. I think there's the issue of payment, you know.
Or not.
Exactly. But also, and I know this because years ago I used to work in events, and since we launched DICE also, I've started to help events organisers find people, a more diverse pool of people. Women say, when it comes to events, women say yes less. They also are more inclined to pull out more. I've chaired lots of panels. I get called in to do last minute stuff all the time to boost the female numbers. So the amount of shit that I talk about, I literally have no idea. I've read up on the day before just so that there can be a female participant. But anyway, I've chaired panels, and more often than not, the women will want to know every single question so they can rehearse the hell out of their answer. And I think the reason for all of those things is because it's a perfection thing. You think women more so think they don't have, they're not allowed to mess up as much. People want them to be perfect more. Women believe they are judged more. There's a load of like complex psychological grooming issues that have been with us since bloody, you know, school. That all lead to the fact that men are statistically more likely to put themselves forward for this kind of thing, which is why I've launched Practice Makes Unperfect, which is the course that I'm doing, which is all about helping women feel more confident just being themselves. and not worrying about being this kind of perfect version of themselves when they present. Oh my God. So there was a, there was a study recently done amongst women, like 5,000 women, conducted weirdly by Ripley's Believe It or Not, which is that, bloody
weird place.
Anyway, they conducted a survey of women's biggest fears. Number three was public speaking, behind only a family member dying and being buried alive. It was a list of 88 fears, like agoraphobia, arachnophobia. Public speaking was third. So this is what we're dealing with.
And actually finding initiatives, because this is the other, this is the like supply side thing, isn't it? Because it's one thing to try to be able to get more people of greater diversity at events. But if people haven't seen people like them talking at events, then there isn't the role models to be able to follow. And so initiatives like what you're doing there, initiatives like, was it Lauren Curry who was doing stuff? Was it Upfront, she called it, where she'd get invite at events women to be able to just sit on the stage behind the speaker so they could just get the sense of what it was to be on stage at an event, which is a brilliant idea. And being able to help to be able to enable people to be more confident in that. You know, I've done a few speaking gigs over my time. I spent 2 years doing it basically full time when I was doing management training. And it was a heck of a thing to learn. I'm naturally introverted and I kind of push myself out of that all the time. But it took the opportunities to be able to be there and to just say, oh, you know, there's that person I know who does it and I can recognize them because they're a bit like me. And so there is that, the two sides of it that need to be addressed to be able to enable this to get better, isn't there?
Well, I saw, Matt, I remember seeing your presentation at Silicon Beach. Do you remember? And you did the presentation about how you have imposter syndrome. And it was just, it was one of the best presentations I've ever seen. It was like choreographed. It was so, it wasn't like slick, like a TED talk is, you know, like really fake. But it was just so, it was just such a good, human, interesting presentation. I remember you had the arrows pointing down saying, he is an imposter. When you were walking around the stage.
It's nice to know that. The main reason that one was good because it was Marcus John Henry Brown had sat at the front. And before I started speaking, he said, if you mess this up, I'm going to punch you in the face. And that was what was keeping me going for that. What can people do to find out more about these things? So first of all, with DICE, if people in our audience see yet another shitty IT event where they've organised it with all male panels, what can they do with the event organisers and DICE?
All they have to do is point them towards getdice.co.uk. Now, I'm going to be quite punchy and say that because it's based on equality law, technically, people can say to an events organiser that has an all-male lineup, you're breaking the law. Do you want to be hosting an illegal event?
It's all right, for goodness sake.
It sounds a bit like 80s, that. It sounds good.
And they're like, yeah. Absolutely. But when you start to, you know, when you start to throw the law around, people all of a sudden, when it for the most part, people will only change if there's money involved or their reputation, is what I've realised. So
absolutely. And then for your new sort of training thing, how can people find out more about that?
So it's a partnership with a magazine called New Digital Age. So you can just go to their website and it's sitting on there. So the wonderful thing about the course is that we get across 6 weeks, we get to practice doing podcasts. We get to practice. They all get to write a thought leadership piece. They get to present at the end and they do that with the magazine. So it's like active profile building. Amazing. Which is nice.
Awesome. We'll put links as well on the website at wb40podcast.com. Amy, thank you very much.
Thank you both.
Well, that was very good, wasn't it? Very interesting, mildly inspiring. We've got lots to work on there. And we've got to look forward to next week as well, because it's an immediate thing which is upon us. And even though it's a little bit later in the week, we've got still a few days left. Matt, what are you up to this week? What's going to happen?
What's going to happen? Oh, I don't know. I mean, lockdown possibly. I've ordered a badge machine. I'm very excited. I've got this idea, right? Because you know, it's my significant birthday coming up at the end of the month, And so I've been doing this project about counting down my entire life through 51 albums for the 51 calendar years what I've been on the planet, which is kind of, I like having these little projects every so often. And so that's coming to a close. So I thought about a project for the year ahead. So I'm going to do a project involving button badges, you know, the little inch wide things, where there will be a series of 12 badges that will sum up my influences in my life. And then if you send me a self-addressed stamped envelope, you will get one, because the Blue Peter gene is strong in me from my mother.
So this is it. This is going to be your legacy. This is going to be the thing that you leave on this earth after you, you pass on, that you're going to leave these badges for posterity, for people to
see. But it's because originally I was going to order them, but then I was chatting to Steve Chapman, ex of this parish, and he sort of mentioned, oh, yeah, no, because I'm testing with him whether it's just stupid or whether it's stupid but still worth doing.
You're testing with Steve Chapman whether some sort of artistic idea.
Validation. That was it. All I wanted was validation.
You went to that for an answer, yes, you should do it, didn't you? You didn't go to check whether it was stupid or not at all, did you, Matt?
But you see, the thing is, what it meant was that I then, out of that conversation, realized that I could buy a badge making machine and 500 badges for 70 quid. And it costs like 40 quid to get just 50 of them done. So, like, that would be 40 bucks. So now I'm just going to make random badges. So it's like gamification of entire real world life. And then somebody says, it does anything good, rather than giving them some, you know, virtual points on a virtual thing, I'm going to make and send them a badge.
Is it manual? Is it some sort of, is it like an artisan thing where you have to line everything up and crimp everything down?
Absolutely.
All the machine is a thing that you can squash your finger with if you're not careful.
Absolutely.
So it's not like a thing where you can pour all the bits in one end. I'm not interested in that. I thought it was an actual badge machine, not just some sort of press that. All right. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll buy some blank badges. I'll send them to you from manufacturing, and you can. I've got an idea for the starve a kid to save a quid badges, the Rishi Sunak badges. We'll get some of them made.
So anyway, yes, that's my week ahead. And then trying to convince my wife that I haven't completely lost it. But, you know, it's so much cheaper as a midlife crisis for a 70 quid badge machine in comparison to a Ferrari. That's what I say. Amy, what's your week ahead looking like?
So it's still reading week. I've got, what even day is it? Wednesday. I am writing a sitcom, an audio sitcom, and I need to finish it. So I've got 2 days. It's almost, we've got the actors. We're going to be recording it in the next couple of months. But I need to finish it. And it's that boring editing stage where you've just seen what you've written so much that you hate it, but you have to persevere and get it done. So I'm finishing writing my sitcom for the rest of this week.
I dream of getting to that point of a book or something at any point.
Are you still writing that book?
Yeah, I am still writing that. I'm back on it. I took a hiatus when I got a job, but now I've decided to start on it again. So I have been doing some planning work for it, and I'm working with an actual professional writer now to motivate myself in actually getting it done. So there we go. Anyway, thank you very much again for joining us this week. An absolute delight. And we, dear listener, we'll hopefully be joining you again next week. And I can't remember who's on we've got an amazing lineup of guests over the next few weeks. So there's going to be another one, and it'll be really exciting. And I look forward to it. So until then, thank you, Amy. Cheerio, Chris. And see you next week.
Cheers.
You have been listening to the WB40 podcast. If you want to get some more in your ears, then go to WB40podcast.com or follow them on Twitter. On their Twitter account.